Well, our argument next in number 2007-1109, Monsanto against Bayer Bioscience. Mr. Pozniak.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. With all due respect to Judge Weber, the decisions in this case and the process by which these decisions came about are so fundamentally unfair that the case cries out for relief. The trial court here allowed an unconstrained trial that failed to observe fundamental rules of patent law. For example, the trial court declared unenforceable patents that were not before it. It found inequitable conduct.
What do you mean? I don't understand that argument. The judge was supposed to decide the attorney's fees issue. And are you saying that the judge can't decide an inequitable conduct issue as part of the attorney's fees issue?
No, the court can decide inequitable conduct and had to decide inequitable conduct as part of the attorney fee issue. However, holding a patent unenforceable is a different matter because the patents had been withdrawn from the case, admittedly. The court said the patents were not before the court. The Super SAC disclaimer had been filed, and so there was no Article III jurisdiction to declare unenforceability. The issue.
But isn't a finding of inequitable conduct going to automatically render the patent unenforceable?
It may, but it doesn't mean that the court has Article III jurisdiction to declare unenforceability.
Is what you're saying that the panel can decide inequitable conduct as part of the attorney's fees, but it just can't issue an order finding the patents unenforceable?
That's correct, because it has no Article III jurisdiction to decide anything involving unenforceability, validity, or infringement, because there is no case or controversy on that issue before the court.
What about
the...
Let's continue with your line of questioning.
Maybe Judge Garza was going to ask about his Fort Hunt opinion. Doesn't that suggest that if you allow the infringement claim to go forward for a period of time in the case, that you can't just sort of in the middle of the case dismiss and achieve a Super SAC dismissal? Isn't that sort of the distinction between Fort Hunt and Super SAC? Are you familiar with Fort Hunt?
Yes, Your Honor, but in this case the court itself had recognized that in the decision that followed the Super SAC disclaimer that it didn't have jurisdiction over these patents and only had jurisdiction to determine attorney's fees.
Well, so maybe the district court was wrong.
Your Honor, the Super SAC is what it is, and if a disclaimer is filed at any time during the course of the case, presumably there is no case or controversy at that time.
Fort Hunt holds the opposite.
Your Honor, I can't quote that case.
After a jury verdict, but moments before the judge actually signs the judgment, you could pull everything, and makes everything go poof?
Your Honor, the Fort James case now comes back to mind. In that case, you really did have the case already, I believe, already decided or presented to the jury. In this case, the Super SAC disclaimer was filed long before any trial. And again, there was no question by the district court that those cases were out of the case, and that is how the case proceeded up until the judge issued his decision and order. So,
but what Fort James says is that Super SAC doesn't, as Judge Bryson was suggesting, that Super SAC doesn't mean that you can dismiss any time you want to. There are limits on that. In Fort James, it was a situation in which the dismissal came after the jury verdict. But maybe this is a question of first impression. Maybe if the dismissal comes after discovery and in the middle of the case, maybe it's too late to do it.
Well, Your Honor, if that was the case, it would be presumably something that would have been raised by Monsanto or any other adversary. In this case, neither Monsanto nor the court raised that as an issue. It was admittedly out of the case up until the judge issued his decision. So if it's not a super sac disclaimer issue where the court has no jurisdiction, and I do believe that the Article III jurisdiction has to exist at all times, that is the reason, for example, that sometimes cases become moot during its pendency and cases are dismissed as moot because of intervening events. But even leaving that to one side, there is an issue of due process when everyone agrees that the case is out and the court says that the patents are out, and then all of a sudden we have an issue decided in a decision and order. If I may then go to the first issue, I'll start with Monsanto's defense of prior.
That's right, Judge Dyke was right. Judge Dyke
followed up
the
question I asked on Fort James.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
But that's all right. Proceed.
Okay. I started with Monsanto's defense of prior inventorship under 102G. A critical and well-established rule in determining priority of invention is that both conception and reduction to practice of a claimed invention require that the inventors recognize and appreciate the limitations of the claimed invention. Here, the invention is a gene encompassing a specified promoter and encoding a very specific BT toxin protein that has the amino acid sequence listed in sequence ID number 1 in the claims. Monsanto essentially admits that its inventors did not recognize or appreciate that their gene encoded that particular BT toxin protein and did not know what they had. Monsanto first admits that its people did not know the full sequence of its gene or protein until at least April 1986, which is months after.
But they had deposited it.
I'm sorry?
They had deposited it. At least for written description, the deposit's sufficient.
That's what they deposited was not the gene of the patent. What they deposited was an E. coli plasmid that had many different elements, but it included a full-length BT, not the truncated BT, no promoter or anything else. But moreover, a deposit may be sufficient for a patent as a written description for that particular patent. A deposit is not a written description of the claims that are here in issue, which require a very specific BT protein. Moreover, we need to be careful that we do not confuse written description, deposits, possession with 102G's requirement of appreciation and recognition. This court has repeatedly held that mere possession of a material does not mean that a person recognizes or appreciates what are the inherent or intrinsic properties or functions of that material that they possess. Possession does not mean that you have a written description of a different invention. And so it is all of these arguments eventually turn on inherency. And we do know that inherency is something that is important for Section 102A or B cases, where you have something in the public domain and then the argument properly is made. If it's in the public domain, then you can't get a patent on it simply because you have identified a new property of it.
Mr. Pozniak, you don't have much time, but could you get directly to the issue as to where the lower court erred in the finding of inequitable conduct? Because
yes,
that covers all of the issues. I don't know if we agree with the lower court, all the other issues don't matter.
That is correct, Your Honor, and I will address it. The issue, I will say at the beginning, is not a matter of discretion, because discretion is not absolute and it's not a matter of arbitrariness. The court cited two grounds for the 565 patent being unenforceable. The first was that a Belgian patent agent, Dr. Muehlmans, allegedly withheld some handwritten notes. The article itself was given to the patent office, but not the copy that had these handwritten scribbles. The court found materiality based on only one fact, and that was that he said that these notes showed that Barnes, quote, coded for the same 67 KD toxin protein Bayer wanted to claim. And because of the identified XHO site, it would be easy to determine the identity of the gene being used, unquote.
Why were not the Mariani notes material to be disclosed to the patent office?
First of all, what the judge said was admittedly wrong. Those notes do not disclose any particular gene or protein. No one supported that suggestion at the court. And in fact, the only evidence was that those notes do not disclose what the gene is or what the protein is.
Are those notes in the appendix?
Pardon?
Are the notes in the appendix?
Yes, they are. The notes are at A39161. Actually, it's A39160 is one copy, and 39161 is another copy.
Which volume is that in?
This is in volume 6. These are the notes. All they show is that there was some, that Barnes had some gene that could encode a 67 KD protein, and that that whatever he got did not work in plants. Did not work in plants. No one has been able to identify, even today, what that gene or protein is. Therefore, the court's basic finding of materiality is admittedly wrong. If the court's basic materiality finding is wrong, what can you do? Monsanto admits this. This is why they went in and tried some end-arounds. First, Monsanto argued, well, there was other materiality, except the judge never found that materiality to be proven or that it was material.
Didn't the notes really disclose that Barnes had succeeded in making a fusion of the first 67 KDs or the BT protein?
Yes, and I believe that could be interpreted, but that is cumulative testimony, cumulative information, because it is admitted that the examiner already had before him an ADANG reference that specifically showed a 67 KD gene and protein that had an identified sequence, both the gene and the toxin. In fact, the examiner cited that during the prosecution. All that was admitted. So therefore, merely showing that you had a 67, someone had a 67 KD gene and protein is cumulative testimony.
Look, the protein could be expressed, and when expressed, displayed the toxicity to the insects, right? Wasn't that the summary of the poster that Dr. Mariani put together?
Right, but that again is also found in the ADANG gene article, the same information. What is relevant is that when Barnes had this unidentifiable gene and protein and put it into a plant, it didn't work. And that's what the notes say.
Well, what
was the cumulative nature of this argued to the district court?
Yes, it was.
And was there testimony about the cumulative nature?
Yes, it was.
Who testified to that?
I believe that was presented through Mariani, and the article showing the 67 KD protein was in front of the court and argued. Judge Weber simply ignored the issue.
But I thought Mariani did not testify in person. She testified only through the notes, right?
No, she testified in person. And she testified at the trial that in fact the handwritten notes do not show anything more material than what the actual abstract said, which was presented.
Was there testimony the other way on the cumulativeness?
I believe that was part of the... I believe that when Dr. Mariani testified that there was nothing more in those notes than what was in the abstract itself. That
no, no, I don't mean cumulativeness in that sense. I mean cumulativeness in the sense of the molecular weight.
I'm not sure if there was direct testimony on it, but it was not disputed because the Adang gene article was part of the prosecution history. It was before the court, and it was argued by counsel to the court. So the cumulative nature of it is apparent from the written record. I'm not sure that testimony to that effect would have made any difference.
I was under the impression that Dr. Meyermans had testified that the reason why he did not submit the Mariani notes was because they were not decipherable.
Dr. Meyermans testified that when he saw these notes, he didn't understand what they meant. And I think anyone who looks at these notes would appreciate that that's a rational explanation. He said he asked Dr. Mariani, who by that point had already left Bayer and was working for someone else. He had asked her what did these notes mean, and she said, oh, I don't remember.
But she clearly testified, though, in her deposition that she had remembered what they were.
She testified after being presented with the handwritten notes, during a lengthy deposition being prepared by Monsanto's counsel, having discussed that with counsel. Yes, after you start going through these notes, one piece by another piece, yeah, you start refreshing your recollection, and at that point she did remember.
But they were decipherable at that point.
Okay.
They were decipherable at that point.
It was decipherable at that point, but again, without her sitting down and explaining what all these handwritten scribbles meant, no one can rationally be expected to look at this and understand what these things are.
Well, it's tough to read them even from that copy, but I presume the original copy is decipherable by the author herself.
No, there is no original copy. What you see here is it was just a copy that looked just like this. That's in 39160. There was nothing more to it than that.
Now, what troubled the judge more than anything, I think, if I understand the judge's reaction, was the response by the prosecuting attorney to the argument from Barnes. And that's the response at page 35965. Among other things, saying that it was that Barnes was not enabled.
I'm sorry.
The Barnes abstract was just didn't show anything of significance because, among other things, it wasn't enabled. And the problem was, as the judge found, that that wouldn't have been possible to say if the notes, as described in her deposition by Dr. Mariani, had been disclosed to the patent office.
Your Honor, I don't believe that Judge Weber said that was the basis for his materiality. Judge Weber, in the course of writing his opinion, put in huge amounts of quotes and arguments that Monsanto had made. But when you got to his statement of what was material about the Barnes notes, I believe that he pointed only to the fact that it coded for the same 67 KB. This is where he said this was the materiality. But regardless of that, what Dr. Meulemans said is correct. Those handwritten notes do not identify a gene or a protein. They don't identify anything that worked, and in fact said it doesn't work in a plant. How can you have something that is meaningful or material when you don't know the have no idea what the gene is and have no idea what the protein is? How can that be material to any issue, particularly when you already have the examiner having a described gene with a described protein already before him?
But wasn't Bayer's argument before the patent examiner, though, correct me if I'm wrong, that the Barnes construct was in the abstract was non-toxic and non-enabled? Wasn't that the essence of their argument before the patent examiner?
And it is correct.
So that's incorrect then as to what Barnes showed, isn't it?
No, it is not incorrect because there is no enablement here. The handwritten, if any enablement existed, the enablement has to exist in this abstract because there is no additional enablement in these handwritten notes because there's still, again, no gene and no protein. Second, the only...
Are you talking about Mariani's notes, the handwritten notes?
Right, right. But this is what we're talking about, is right here. Mm. And there's no enablement here any more than anything here. This is why Dr. Mariani pointed out that these notes don't describe anything more than is already in here in the actual abstract, other than pointing out that there was a 67 KB section. But in regarding
which was enabled and which was toxic.
No, it wasn't enabled because how can you enable something where you have no idea what the sequence is? To have enablement of a gene, you have to have some ability to at least identify the gene. But there's no enablement here because no one knows what the gene is. How can you work with a gene that you have no idea what it is?
What do the notes say? I mean, there's sort of a paucity of information about that in the briefs. Where do we find in the record somebody reading the handwriting and saying what's there?
And that's in Dr. Mariani's testimony.
Her deposition.
Her deposition.
Her deposition is much more. Well, but the deposition is much more complete on that score. She seemed to, at least the judge found, and I did too, that her recollection didn't seem to be quite as crisp by the time she got to trial.
No, I think she didn't change anything that she said before. At trial, I think she answered questions that weren't asked at her deposition.
Yeah.
At her deposition, for example, she wasn't asked, what is the difference between what is in the actual abstract and what is in the notes. She was asked that question at trial and did answer that. Regardless of whether we look at her deposition or her trial testimony, as you go through it, the one thing that is apparent is that everything that is in the handwritten notes, other than this quote-unquote 67 KD number, is in the abstract itself. So, and what is clear is that all Barnes's notes show on toxicity is, yeah, you take this 67, some unidentified 67 KD protein, and if you feed it directly to insects, not in a plant, but just feed it directly without a plant promoter or anything, yeah, it'll kill the insects. But again, that's old art. That's in the ADANG article. The only material fact was that where you needed a plant promoter and needed the plant promoter to control the coding sequence for the BT, it didn't work.
Was there anybody who took her deposition testimony and her notes, an expert on the other side, who testified this is what you would conclude from that?
No, the entirety of the testimony relevant to this was...
Is her testimony. And her notes.
But I think you had, of course, Mr. Bulkasian, who said, well, this was material, but Mr. Bulkasian is not an expert in the art. But there is no suggestion anywhere in the record, and Monsanto has not argued any, that someone could identify what the gene was or what the protein was.
Well,
let me understand it correctly, now, the Barnes was before the Patent Office. It was submitted as a particular reference before the Patent Office. And Bayer said that does not disclose a non-toxic and non-abled. That's what the Barnes abstract argument was before the Patent Office.
Right.
Now, if I understand it correctly, once again, correct me if I'm wrong, the Mariani notes showing the Barnes poster, right, disclosed that Barnes had succeeded in making a fusion of the first 67 KD of the PT protein and the MPT chitinemycin resistance gene, that this gene would be expressed. Is that correct or is that wrong?
It may have been expressed, but it did not express the gene because the BT protein in a plant cell, because when he put it into a plant cell, there was no activity, and so there was no toxicity. Barnes could only get toxicity by expressing the gene in bacteria, just like, you know, it's a completely different issue. And you express it in the gene, you feed it to an insect, and yeah, the insect dies. But what relevance does that toxicity have to anything that's involved here? There is none. Because, again, that was information that was in a couple pieces of prior art before the examiner, including the Eidang article. There was no indication that the gene that included the fusion protein, the plant promoter, you know, plant cell, or any of those things, was toxic. And in fact, the exact opposite was true. It wasn't toxic, so said Barnes.
But if the Mariani notes show that the Barnes expression was toxic, displayed toxicity to insects, then it would have been a material reference to be shown to the Patent Office. Hypothetically.
The mere fact that, I'm sorry, because it's not, it, the Barnes, I'm sorry, Mariani's notes indicate that the 67 KD protein itself, when fed to insects and not in a plant cell, what she called in a drop form, that was toxic. And what I'm saying is that is not material because it's cumulative. That's old stuff, so it can't be material. If the reference or these handwritten notes hypothetically demonstrated that this construct worked inside a plant cell with a plant promoter and everything else, then perhaps a little more material, but still I don't think it would be material, because how can something be material if you have no idea how to make it? There's no indication of what the gene is or what the protein is, and so how can that be tied into anything that was material? It is no different than someone coming off the street and saying, "Gee, I got your invention. I got something, but I'm not going to tell you what it is." And is that prior art? Is that material? I don't think so.
Okay, why don't we hear from the appellee now, and we will reserve your full 3 minutes of rebuttal time. And if you, Mr. Benjamin, could add, let me see, what was it? I think about 12 and a half minutes to Ms. Nall's time. Thank you. If you need it.
May it please the court. With respect to the inequitable conduct determination by the district court judge, I think that Bayer and its briefs take out of context exactly what all the district court found and try to collapse it all into this one single event about the Mariani notes to then declare.
Let's focus on the notes. Help us with the notes. We've asked a lot of questions about that. What's material about the notes? They say that the things the notes reveal are cumulative. Is that true?
It is not true.
Why not?
Because in the prosecution history, in describing the Barnes reference, The statement is made at A35-965, as Judge Bryson pointed out, is that this is the only characterization of the Barnes abstract. Now, keep in mind, it was just an abstract of the entire poster session, not the
It's the little chunk that's above the notes.
The little chunk that's above the notes.
A typewritten material.
Yeah. So there was a characterization of that abstract by directed by Dr. Mulemans that says, Barnes fails to identify which BT toxin gene should be utilized, also fails to show that the fusion gene would work in plants, also if the second half of the BT gene would be deleted, Barnes suggests the remaining part of the 578 amino acids is not toxic. And it goes on to talk about Hofty, and it says, but no concrete evidence is provided. This is about Barnes. Barnes doubts whether or not the two halves of the fused gene remain together in the gene product. Now, contrast that with what Dr. Mariani said about her notes. And it is a very, very important distinction as to what she testified to in her deposition and what she testified to at the actual trial. Because the district court found that difference to be very significant and found her testimony at trial not to be credible. Because in her deposition, as
Wait, before you go on to that.
Okay.
They've made two points. I want to see whether you agree with them or not. They first say that the Mariani notes don't show that Barnes is toxic in plants, only with bacteria. Is that true?
That's true. It shows a toxic protein. But the claim as instructed to the jury and as construed by the district court does not require toxicity in plants. Now, and that's a very significant point because in order to distinguish the other three patents which Bayer withdrew from the case, they said that's the distinction. Those patents are directed to expression in plants. This is just a gene claim. So in order to evaporate this infectious unenforceability argument that was being made earlier in the case, Bayer went to the district court, made the distinction that somehow those patents require BT expression in plants, but this one does not. So it's a very important distinction. Now, what it did show, the poster session showed a 67 KD protein. That
was
toxic.
So they say that the molecular weight is also cumulative. What's the answer to
that? It's not cumulative because 67 KD doesn't appear on the abstract anywhere. The only place the 67 KD appears is in her notes. And she testified in her deposition to exactly what that meant. She also testified that it would have been easy for her to determine what the gene was because of this cleavage.
What about their contention that this particular molecular weight is cumulative? They had other.
It is not cumulative because, and this is where Bayer's been trying to play at both sides for both infringement and validity issues, because in order to distinguish the Adang reference before the patent office, they said Adang was a grounds of rejection because it shows a 67 KD protein on a Western blot. Bayer argued in order to obtain allowance of this claim, but Adang encodes a 100 KD protein. So because it encodes a 100 KD protein, our claims are different because we claim 60 to 80. So it's a very important distinction.
But they say there was other prior art within the 60 to 80 range.
That was a Dang encoding of 100 KD protein, but showed a 67 KD protein on a Western blot. So there was the only other prior art or the
principle. So there wasn't prior art that showed a 67 KD protein by Western blot.
Correct. And that was the Dang article. But in order to distinguish that, in order to obtain allowance of the claims, and this is at A35-991, and you can see the argument was made not once, but twice, and there was an examiner interview to persuade the examiner that somehow Adang was different because it encoded an over 100 KD protein, and that was the basis of allowance.
Okay, this is all very interesting. Let me tell you what my problem is. My problem is the judge didn't say any of this. When he reached the inequitable conduct thing, it looks from the opinion as though he believed that her notes show that it was the same gene.
No, he didn't. Mm. And I think that takes the judge's one comment out of context because he says size was the issue. I mean, all throughout this trial, the size of the produced protein was the issue.
But where does he say all the stuff that you just said?
Well, in the district court opinion, he says, and this is where it's taking his opinion out of context, For all of the reasons, if we go to the very end of the district court's opinion at A63.37, the next to the last page of the opinion, in the second paragraph on the bottom, the court finds by clear and convincing evidence that for all the reasons cited in this opinion, Bayer knew when the Barnes notes were not disclosed to the PTO.
Okay, so where are the other reasons cited?
Starting at A17 and...
Yeah, but, I mean, like, take the things that you just said. Where do they appear in here?
Now, if you start at A20... At the bottom of the page, it says, Dr. Mariani's testimony stands in sharp contrast to that of Dr. Muleman's. While in front of the poster, she made a drawing of the same schemes presented on the poster. She is very clear in her description of her notes and her testimony concerning those notes, contrary to the testimony of Dr. Muleman's. Dr. Mariani recalls a great deal about the notes, and in her deposition testimony...
Yeah, yeah, but that's not saying that that's not a finding of materiality similar to the one that you were arguing that the judge should have made. Where do I find these other findings of materiality? What I've got is a very cryptic statement, which on its face seems very likely to be wrong, in which he seems to think that the Mariani note showed that the Barnes poster showed the same gene, or the same protein. And you've said that this was material for other reasons, and I'm looking to see where.
Well, if you go through the next, the district court thought it was significant enough to list then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, almost 6 pages
of her
testimony.
That's not a finding. That's a quote from the trial.
A26 at the bottom.
A26?
Yes, okay. A26. It is very obvious that the poster notes, if they were disclosed to the patent examiner, which they were not, would stand in sharp contradiction to the Bayer argument before the patent office.
And this goes back to the argument made at 35.965?
Correct.
All right.
So, scattered throughout the district court's opinions are other findings that support, and the district court was confronted with all of this evidence at trial. It's not any new evidence. What Mr. Pozniak was arguing is just re-arguing the same things the district court heard.
Yeah,
and in this...
Go ahead.
In this case, the district court made express findings about the credibility of these two witnesses. And at the very...
That's not enough to find inequitable conduct. I mean, he's got to tell us why it's material. And what I'm looking for, and I'm still not seeing, is some detailed description of why this is material.
Well, I think the district court...
I mean, you're asking us to sort of imply from some fragments in here and the fact that he quoted a lot of the testimony that he's made particular findings. I think that's sort of hard.
Well, I think that there are sufficient statements throughout the district court's opinion, including the one at A26, which shows that he understood the differences between the abstract and the actual poster session and what Dr. Mariani recorded. And if you go again at the end of the district court's opinion, I can get back to it. At the end of the district court's opinion, on A63.36, it says, Bayer has enormous credibility problem on this point in the litigation, inherited primarily from Dr. Muleman's, but to a lesser extent, Dr. Mariani. Later on in the paragraph, he says, at trial, she attempted to downplay her understanding of the notes and her ability to recall what they report and their significance. She said in her deposition that she thought she was doing something beneficial when she took the notes, but later...
But that's not a finding of materiality, don't you? What I'm saying is, where are these detailed findings of materiality? You offered a very cogent and lengthy explanation as to why this is material. I don't see that in this opinion. You're asking me to imply it from some very general statements. I find that difficult.
Well, I think it's the difference, as the district court found, between the description in the file history of what Barnes actually disclosed, and I think that's what offended the district court the most. The difference between what the description Muleman's provided to the about Barnes and what they actually knew about Barnes, and that is contained within the district court's opinion.
But there's no specific language in there saying that I find this material matter that should have been disclosed to the patent office. There's no specific language that affect in his opinion. You have to essentially tease it all out of his opinion.
Yeah, the 99-page opinion. And I would point out to the court and remind the court that was not the only basis for finding inequitable conduct in the 565 patent. The second basis was due to Dr. Mulemans, and as he says in the opinion, primarily due to Dr. Mulemans and his statement that the problem of gene expression had been solved.
Mulemans' statement, right?
Pardon?
That was not Mulemans' statement.
It was Mulemans directed the prosecution. It's undisputed.
Yeah, but it's not his statement. It's not in an affidavit from him or
it's
something
not
like
an
that.
Affidavit
it was by the lawyer,
correct.
Right?
He admitted that he was responsible for the prosecution. He was admitted there were actually memos from him directing the U.S. attorneys on what to say and what arguments to make in this particular amendment. So even though you can't attribute the exact statement to his pen, clearly Dr. Mulemans was intimately involved in directing the U.S. attorneys as to what to say and what arguments to make when he knew exactly to the contrary.
Can we go back again? Because I do think the whole Barnes issue is really the most important core element of the trial court's inequitable conduct finding. What, in your view, in light of the testimony of the notes and the testimony given by Mariani, particularly in her deposition where she sort of goes through and circles things and identifies them by number and so forth, she did quite an elaborate job of annotating the notes. Can you give us, in fairly condensed form, what exactly, in your view, the notes add to the abstract?
The notes add the fact that it was a 67 KD protein.
All right. Now that much Mr. Pizzuniac concedes.
That it was toxic.
Okay, Mr. Pizzuniac says as to that it was already known.
But not in the description to the patent office as represented by Dr. Mulemans and Bayer. They said it didn't, at page A35, 965, it says it would not be toxic. So they're misdirecting the examiner to looking at a different portion of the gene that says, okay, if you take the first 578,
and
it's not toxic.
This is the point at which it says toxic for larvae as drops, but not toxic if the construct is in leaves. Correct?
Correct?
Am I reading the language
you're right,
correctly?
You're reading it
this
correctly.
Isn't as hard to read, actually, is it?
Yeah.
All right. Maybe I'm just used to my own handwriting.
So there's 67 KD. There's the fact that Barnes' gene was toxic at a 67 KD fragment, that he had actually made a
toxic
chimeric.
Toxic in bacteria, but not plants.
That's right. And as instructed, it doesn't require toxicity in plants.
Okay. That's two things. All right.
That
what
he
else?
Had, in fact, made a chimeric gene connecting a promoter to this truncated toxic BT portion.
Now this promoter, is that, what sort of promoter is that? That he reflected in the notes?
That he had, well, it's in the notes where he had connected it to a promoter. Oh, I think it's a agrobacterium promoter. But nevertheless, he had connected a promoter to.
Well, there's this. There are a couple of rectangles that represent the gene. Is there some portion of that that represents the promoter?
And there's a T and an I.
Right.
So that represents that it was in a bacterial plasma.
Okay.
So.
Okay.
As Dr. Mariani explained in her notes. So those are three things that are clearly different from what Barnes' abstract said and what it was represented to be to the examiner by Bayer.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And here, the other distinction about what they said is, again, at that page A35965, is that it, quote, may be inserted. When in fact the notes from the poster made clear that Dr. Barnes had actually done it.
Okay, but the three things that you listed to Judge Bryson, if I understand correctly,
One is in the opinion, but in a sentence that could suggest that the district court thought it was the same gene, right?
I think that misconstrues the sentence. I think the district court
But in any event, there's a question of construction about it. So, there's some ambiguity in the sentence, isn't there?
Well, I don't think there is, because the claim requires a protein. It doesn't require the exact same gene. It doesn't require the exact same DNA sequence or identity of DNA sequence. All it requires is a DNA sequence that encodes a 60 to 80 KD toxic BT protein. It doesn't have to be the exact same toxic BT protein. It doesn't specify a specific DNA sequence that is required.
Well, the portion, I take it that the portion that is specified in, say, claim 3, which is sequence ID number 1 from amino acid position 29 to amino acid position 607 and 725, those are all part of the BT, the native BT gene, correct?
Yes.
I mean, everybody's playing with that.
Right.
Right. So that's not anything new, correct? I mean, that's just, that's a chunk taken directly from the bacteria.
Correct. Right. And to answer your question about the promoter, Dr. Mariani testifies at page A25 that where it says next to the right border, there's a nopaline synthase promoter.
Mm-hmm.
So it was actually a nopaline synthase promoter, not the TI reflected the whole plasmid. So the actual promoter component came from a nopaline synthase.
All right.
So where do I find 2 and 3 in the district court's opinion?
That it was toxic?
Well, that sentence uses the word toxic. But he doesn't focus. He doesn't get to the same level of detail that you did.
Well,
right?
But that's where we have to go back to A2226. And at A23. Where she explains that, you know, kanamycin is expressed and is toxic to larvae. What does that mean?
Yeah, but that's the problem. This is testimony. It's not findings. The question is, did he give us enough to work with here? And what we seem to boil down to is one sort of cryptic sentence.
But it's an important cryptic sentence that refers back to the rest of the findings and the discussion in the entire 99-page opinion. And as I said, it's not the only basis on which the district court found inequitable conduct in the 565 patent.
Are these alternative grounds, that the statement about predictability?
Yes.
It's not an alternative ground.
It's an additional ground.
Yeah, but how do I know that standing alone would be sufficient in the judge's mind to render the patent unenforceable?
Because he considered them separately. He made first, beginning at A63.34, the discussion about Dr. Newlemon's.
Does he say one without the other is sufficient?
Yeah, he finds at A63.35, the court finds by clear and convincing evidence for all of those stated reasons that Bayer knew that when the representation was made that unpredictability of gene expression had been solved, that representation was false and misleading, and that it was submitted to the patent office with a specific intent to mislead the examiner. So there's a separate and independent finding by the district court that the statement of unpredictability was indeed a separate and distinct ground for finding the inequitable conduct.
I'm not clear that he finds that in of itself would be sufficient.
Well, he made a separate finding as to the Barnes notes. So I think it's fair to interpret the district court as making two separate findings of material information that was withheld with a specific intent as to both of them. He didn't just lump them all into one discussion and then say, aha, I find materiality and intent. He did divide them out into two separate distinct discussions in the district court's opinion. Now, I would like to bring to the court's attention another subject of the questions that were asked of Mr. Pizzuniac, and that is the court's opinion of this court in Nielsen versus Osram, which was 2006 1550, which was decided October 10th of this year, just a few weeks ago. And in that case, this court affirmed a finding of unenforceability for four patents that had been withdrawn from the case just before trial. So further to your point, Judge Bryson, is that there is a point at which a district court has affirmed finding of unenforceability when the patents have been pulled from the trial at some point earlier, even though it had been pending for a long time. And the court found specifically that there was no abuse of discretion by the district court in doing so. The other important point about this, the Nielsen decision, is that the district court is being reviewed here on an abuse of discretion standard. And an abuse of discretion can only be found when, one, the court's decision is clearly unreasonable, arbitrary, or fanciful. We don't have that here. Number two, the court's decision is based on an erroneous construction of law. There's no allegation that there's a legal error in the court's analysis. Three, the court's factual findings are clearly erroneous. And what the district court has told us is that they can't be considered clearly erroneous in these circumstances when he's found inequitable conduct of this patent based on two different pieces of information. And lastly, the record contains no evidence upon which a court could rationally have based its decision. And I think in this instance, the court did rationally base its decision. It spent 4 days at trial, conducted credibility determinations of the witnesses, made findings as to what all of the evidence was, correctly applied the law, and determined that Bayer had committed inequitable conduct in this case.
Do you want to address the question of invalidity for prior invention?
Yes, sir, I would.
Or if you have another subject that you think is more pressing, I don't want to.
Well, it's actually just two issues about the invalidity findings. Now, there was substantial evidence to support the jury's verdict of the invalidity findings, whether it's prior invention or whether it's obvious. The only objection that Bayer poses in the direction of obviousness is that there was no expert testimony that was offered.
Well, but I think what they're saying, to put a correct cast on it, is that there wasn't anybody who explained to the jury reasonable expectation of success, motivation to combine. This is the sort of thing that you normally have to have expert testimony for, and there wasn't any. I mean, the jury on those two issues was just left at sea, right?
No, they weren't, Your Honor. They were properly instructed. The jury was properly instructed on Graham versus John Deere.
No, forget the instructions. What was there any testimony about reasonable expectation of success or motivation to combine?
There was, Your Honor, and the principal testimony came from the Bayer's inventor and primary witness, Dr. Lehmans. Dr. Lehmans was the one who I cross-examined, and it's contained in our appendix site about Dr. Lehmans, about how hard was it to make these genes during that time period. What was known? Were plant promoters known? He admitted, yes, they were. Over and over again, Dr. Lehmans admitted every piece of prior art and actually admitted testimony.
There's no dispute about the prior art. The question is, what does it show? Was there a motivation to combine the prior art? Does anybody testify to that?
Yes, Your Honor. Dr. Lehmans, Dr. Perloff, Dr. Perloff.
Wait. What did they say about these two issues?
What they said about these two issues is that everybody was trying to make genes that worked in plants. BT was the obvious choice because it was a common insecticide that was used in plants. So there was not one, but five research groups that were trying to make this BT gene work. Monsanto was one, Dr. Dang was one, Dr. Bart.
So it was obvious to try.
No, it's not obvious to try. Everybody was doing it. It wasn't a question of obvious to try, and obvious to try never even came up in the course of the trial. But the point is that there was testimony by multiple witnesses as to what the scope and content of the prior art was, what every prior art reference taught. There was expert testimony from Dr. Messing as to what the Adang reference taught. And if you go to Dr. Lehman's testimony, he says exactly what were the obstacles, what were the issues, what was known. And all of this was developed in the course of his testimony. Now, it's also buttressed by the fact of what Dr. Barnes did, what Dr. Fischoff did in his prior invention, but all of the record testimony was to this effect. Now, with respect to the prior invention There was substantial evidence presented to the jury through Drs. Fischoff, Fraley, and Perlack, that they had, and Dr. Fischoff and Kathy Bowdish and others at Monsanto, they had isolated the gene, this BT gene, their own BT gene, for PMAP1202.
Did you agree that you can't rely on inherency?
There is no need to rely on inherency.
So you agree that you can't rely on it?
There's no need to. He did not need to have the specific gene, have full knowledge of the DNA sequence in order to have possession of the protein. And that's exactly what the testimony was at trial, and substantial evidence of it. And that is because they had isolated the gene. They had the exact places where you make the cut to get to the BT protein. It had a detailed restriction map of how it was put together. It was connected to a plant promoter. They deduced that it was the same 107-25 amino acids. They had sequenced at the beginning and at the end, and it had been connected. So all of the elements of the claim are there.
But they didn't know what the molecular weight was.
They didn't know what the molecular weight was. I mean, they knew it was 725 amino acids. From that, you can determine the molecular weight.
Oh, but suppose we were to hold that the Western blot test is the right way to determine molecular weight under this patent. Did they have any idea what the molecular weight was by the Western blot test?
They didn't do it by the Western blot because no Western blot can be read into these claims. I mean, the district court was correct that this issue about the Western blot is a question of infringement, not a question of claim construction. And if Bayer had wanted a claim that said, and you determine it by a Western blot, they should have written that claim. They didn't. And so
there's sufficient disclosure in the written description for the Western blot test, isn't there?
Pardon?
There's sufficient disclosure in the written description to use the Western blot test for the determination of the molecular weight.
No, Your Honor, there's not. And there's not even a Western blot of a BT protein that was put into a plant in the specification. The specification equally talks about proteins encoding and references a Western blot. But there is no requirement in this claim that the testing be done by a Western blot.
But it does reference the Western blot testing process, does it not?
There is, yeah. The words Western blot do appear in the specification. It doesn't tell you how to run it, you know, what the temperature should be. And the inherent unreliability of the Western blot came through the evidence of Bayer's own expert, Dr. G. He ran 4 Western blots and found a 92 kD protein for MON810. He then monkeyed with the experimental variables, heated the corn and cooked it till he degraded the protein and found an 80 kD protein. So if you read Western blot into these claims, it makes it impermissibly vague because you can cook the test any way you want to come up with the number.
So suppose we do read Western blot into these claims. You say we shouldn't, but suppose hypothetically that we do. Where does that leave you on the prior inventorship?
There was still I think Dr. Fischoff did do a Western blot test. I mean, even if you were to do it, it would be the same. But then if you do read Western blot into the claim, then the patent has to be invalid over a Dang, because a Dang did do a Western blot at 67 kD. So Bayer doesn't ever talk about reading a Western blot into the claim in terms of the invalidity defenses, because that makes their invalidity problems even greater. So,
but there's no jury finding of that invalidity on that basis, is there?
On obviousness, Your Honor. So that even if you do read Western blot into the test, it should not disturb the obviousness finding, because a Dang showed a Western blot.
Yeah, but I'm not talking about the
kD.
Obviousness finding. I'm talking about the prior inventorship. You agree that the standard for interference is the same as the standard for 102G, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So we can't, the cases seem, Hitzman seems to suggest we can't rely on inherency. Amgen says you got to be able to distinguish it, you'll be able to describe it in some way or other. And the question is, were you able to describe it in such a way as to satisfy the requirements for a conception reduction to practice?
And there was substantial evidence before the jury that they could. And I would also point out to the court
and give us again, because this is critical, give us again, I mean, they didn't have the sequence, but you're saying they had all but the sequence.
They had all but the sequence.
Now, why don't you give us, if you could, you ran through this again before, but if you could do it, indulge me and do it again, give me what exactly they had and where, well, give me what they had, and then we'll talk about where it is in the record.
And I can give you the page in our brief where
we lay down what all of the ingredients that they had established were present. Our task is to say, all right, how close were you to having the effective complete sequence? Were you basically all but there so that it would be a trivial and silly distinction to say, ah, but you didn't have the last few codons?
It was routine practice in the art at the time, as admitted by Dr. Lehmans, to go through, and once you had the starting point of the protein and the ending point, to go through and determine the DNA sequence itself.
Right.
That was a matter of routine skill in the art at the time. So all it was a matter of time for somebody to go in there and just figure out which was the order of the A's, T's, G's, and C's.
Of course, Why is that the test? I mean, that doesn't seem to me intuitively obvious that that should be the test.
That is not the test, as this court held in N. Ray Criss. It said it's not necessary to... you can't turn something into novel simply by going in...
And sequencing it. The argument is that you can't take somebody else's gene, which they haven't sequenced, sequence it, and then run to the patent office and say, I got there first.
And that's the same principle.
Although one could argue that some of our cases seem to suggest that sequencing is of such importance that maybe that's not necessarily such a silly outcome, but that's a different matter.
But here, as I said before, they isolated the gene, so they already had the starting point and the ending point of the gene. It was made in a public deposit,
all right,
so somebody could go get it and do the sequence of A's, T's, G's, and C's. We had a detailed restriction map of what the gene looked like, where those, you know, the different little markers that these kinds of scientists go in and assign for certain restriction sites, like, you know, KPN1
the,
or BAM.
The cleavage
or
sites, is that
sites.
What you're talking
yeah,
about?
Yeah,
like
we had those
the
cleavage
HBA,
sites identified
whatever it was.
Throughout that section. We knew it would make a toxic BT protein at 100 or 725 amino acids because Dr. Perlack had already tested that in bacteria in 1983.
But that's sort of saying we knew that we had an invention. As I understand 102G, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but what strikes me is that the test is whether you could write the claims that are involved here. Is that a reasonable way of looking at it?
Yes, and Dr. Fischoff could have written the claim based on what he knew at the time.
But he didn't know the molecular weight.
He did know the molecular weight from the 725 amino acids. What he didn't know, the only thing he did not know, was the entirety of the order of the A's, T's, G's, and C's throughout the complete gene. He knew it at the beginning, and he knew some at the end. And he eventually, they went ahead and did the routine experimentation to fill in from beginning to end. But everything Dr. Fischoff had as of April 15, 1985, is what is in claim of the patent.
He had all the amino acids?
Yes.
He just didn't have the nucleotides that particularly coded for those particular amino acids?
He did. That's exactly right. He had the beginning, he had the end. He knew he had a toxic BT fragment. He knew, and that's all the claim requires. So if you go back to the actual wording of the claim, he had everything that was there. Now, we go up further in
did
our...
Did somebody
brief.
Testify what? To this?
Dr. Fischoff did.
He did? He said he could have written the claim? He put it in those terms?
I don't think he was... Was every element... Did you have this element, and this element claim? Yes, sir, he did.
What was the 816 amino acid weight then?
Pardon?
The 816 amino acids?
That was the MON810 gene, the accused product.
That was the accused product, only the accused product.
Correct.
Not the first product, not the 725.
Correct. That was 800, I think it's 816 amino acids for the MON810 product.
So basically the product was changed after the first one. So you never used the first product that was developed?
No, never used the first product that was developed. They went on to find that the real invention here was to make a synthetic gene that would work better in plants instead of bacteria.
So it was a shorter gene, basically.
This was a shorter gene, and what they found is they could make it express as a longer gene by changing the codons throughout the gene.
Very well, I think think we had best move on. I think we have your case. Thank you. Mr. Pizzuniac, your rebuttal.
Coming back to the court's questions regarding the Mariani notes and the Barnes notes, again, I believe when the counsel started talking about toxicity, we again are getting confused between toxicity outside of a plant cell and inside of a plant cell. Regarding the toxicity, I think it's worthwhile in light of the court's questions to make it clear. During the prosecution history, and I'm citing A35946 at the bottom, the examiner specifically rejected the claims on the grounds that Eden et al. Disclosed chimeric genes for transforming plant cells which encode an N-terminal fragment of a BT crystal protein. The size of the protein produced was 60 to 80 KB. That ADANG that is referred to is the ADANG article that begins at A36983 and at A36990. You have in the middle a little table that shows a gene PBT73-383AVA, which shows a gene that both theoretically and by Western blot is 67 KB. So this information about plant cells being transformed with 67 KB proteins, etc., was specifically argued by the examiner, which is why an ADANG shows that it was toxic, as the examiner points out. The distinction between ADANG and this patent was in the sequence, the specific proteins involved. This is why you can't ignore the court's specific holding, which was it was the same protein. Because if it wasn't the same protein, the court presumably recognized it would have been cumulative and the same thing as the examiner had already pointed out. The counsel suggested, on perhaps a little bit to the side, that applicants Bayer had argued that something about something was 67 KB but encoded 100 KB, and that was the distinction with ADANG. That is quite untrue. There were two separate ADANG references. One is the one that we just discussed, which was the gene article, in which there's no question that it was 67 KB, whether you looked at Western blot or calculated. There was another ADANG patent that was unclear as to different sizes. And Ms. Knoll referred to an argument that applicant made with respect to the other ADANG article. But applicant did not say, Bayer did not say that 67 KB, if it's actually produced, is not. It wasn't distinguishing between something that was allegedly calculated and versus something that was produced. Rather, if you look at that point in the discussion, the applicants were actually simply answering a question that the examiner had posed. The examiner had earlier asked, this ADANG patent is unclear whether let me just refer the court to A35947.
And there the examiner said it is not clear if ABANG purposefully truncated the BT gene, unquote. So at A35947, the examiner asked the question. Bayer responded by pointing out that actually in that particular reference, they had created or attempted to create 106 KB reference protein. They found 67 KB, which apparently reflected some degradation or something. So they were merely explaining what happened in one of the prior art references in response to the examiner's question. We're not arguing that there's any distinction between calculated and Western blot. Regarding the 102G questions, Ms. Lowell again refers to some of the information that Monsanto had in their possession. Again, possession does not mean recognition or appreciation. She refers to the fact that they had some sequenced some ends, that they had restriction maps of the gene. Well, that's all fine and good, but it doesn't show appreciation or recognition because, in fact, even then, Monsanto's own witnesses repeatedly admitted they could not distinguish the protein their gene was encoding from the BT protein that Whiteley was encoding. And the gene that encodes a protein sequence of ID number 1 that's in the claims here is different and recognized to be different than the protein that Whiteley had. Whiteley had something that we call a Cry1AA protein. The gene described in the claims encodes a protein that's called Cry1AB.
What is this, without getting too technical, sequence 1 in the claims, for example? I had the impression that that was just, there wasn't anything particularly novel about that. It's just a chunk taken from the bacteria, from the native BT gene, correct?
The sequence ID number 1 is the amino sequence of a portion of a protein that is naturally made by a Bacillus thuringiensis bacteria. However,
and it's between, I think the 607 thought was the one of the identified cleavage points,
There is a 607, there's a 725.
A 725 and a 29 was another cutoff point. So there's nothing particularly magical about those sequences, right?
Other than they do define a very specific protein, which is different than, let's say, the Whiteley protein or many other BT proteins that are out there.